I remember another conversation that I had once that's impacted sort of how I approach this whole question that we've been looking at over the weekend. I was talking to a colleague years ago, and we'd grown up in a similar part of Sydney, not quite neighbouring suburbs, but the same sort of region out in the St. George area. And we were reflecting on the similarities in the kind of culture of our upbringing, and particularly our experience at church. And what we discovered and kind of had a chuckle over was that at youth group, we were both brought up on the principle of you don't have to like someone, you just have to love them. And that was kind of a creed that we'd had with youth group. And you can kind of imagine how that was conceived in the first place. You know, you get some really difficult, awkward people coming along to church youth groups. You can't expect people to kind of, you know, be deeply affectionate towards them. They're so awkward. And so to kind of help you work that through, we were given this little adage. You don't have to like someone, you just have to love them. And that was shared with a solemnity that goes with important theological insights. So, you know, it seemed to almost be a biblical truth, the way that it was conveyed to us. And as we were talking about this, my friend turned to me, he said, then one day I woke up and I thought, what if that's how God feels towards me? What if that's how God loves me? He kind of suffers me as an awkward person, but he loves me. He makes a kind of decision to do good to me, even though at the same time he doesn't particularly warm to me or find me attractive in any way. And we both kind of were stopped in our tracks, and it, you know, it was a very, very sobering thought to think, well, what if that is the way God treats us and relates to us? And so this talk is entitled Living Like Beloved Children. And what I'm really wanting to explore is, what is this thing called love? No, sorry, I put a comma in there. What is this thing called love? That's the topic for the talk, yeah. There are a few words that we put to work as hard in our culture as the word love. I love chocolate. I love Coca-Cola, as my daughter proclaimed yesterday. I make love with my wife. I love seafood. I love Steve Smith. I love Australia. I love the beach. I love my grandchildren. And love, if you analyse just that list that I gave you, love might mean that I would walk in front of a bus to protect the person that I love. Or it might mean I keep a stash in the fridge for when I'm feeling self-indulgent. So you can see it's hard to know how to take the word love to the bank, and I think we find this problem in a lot of our relationships, just working out exactly what love constitutes and what a person means when they say they love me. It's the word that some men know to say if they want a relationship to progress. I love you is like a pin code to get access. And it's a word that some men just cannot bring themselves to say because they are all too aware of what it ought to mean. We use the word so indiscriminately that it ends up meaning very little. It's one of the most slippery words in the language. But there are relationships that we find ourselves in where knowing what the word love means in a conversation is absolutely vital. And that's the kind of problem we find ourselves in. So understandably, over the years, Christians have tried to bring some clarity, tried to bring some analysis to this. Love is such a central word in the Bible that you can't really get by not knowing quite what it means. And so Christians have wanted to restore its dignity and significance, find out what its content is from the point of view of the Bible. And probably the most famous analysis of that kind was C.S. Lewis's famous book, The Four Loves. It's a book that's exactly as old as I am. It was released in the year of my birth. But it's still a go-to resource for a lot of people. I was talking to a psychiatrist just the other day, not in a professional capacity, mind you, but you know, he mentioned the book, and it was kind of still a book that structured the way that he thought about love, a Christian psychiatrist. In the book, Lewis distinguishes four species of love by their Greek words. Eros, erotic love, is attraction love, not necessarily sexual, but very, very often sexual. It's a desire, a longing for some kind of union or intimacy with the object of your affection. You want to possess that object in some way, given eros. And it's not a word you find in the Bible. Apparently the Bible writers were a little bit concerned that if they used that word, it might be confused with the god Eros in Greek mythology. But it's interesting that the Bible avoids using that particular word. Another word is philia or philos, the word for friend. And that's friendship love, born of years of shared experience, having a common outlook with someone that's developed over years, compatible personalities. I'm reliving last night at the moment, but anyway. And a deep loyalty that happens as a result. Friendship love is that easy place that you find yourself in with someone that you've known for a substantial amount of time. As I drove up the other night, I spoke to my bestest friend in the world. We've known each other since we were 8, so it's been a considerable amount of time. And there is no one I talk to like I talk to him. It's just we are so comfortable with each other and we just regularly seek conversations. He still lives in Sydney, but we just seek each other out as regularly as we can to have those kinds of conversations that I simply don't quite have with anybody else. Then there's, the word that C.S. Lewis used was storgos love. Storgos is a Greek word, again, not used in the Bible, for a deep affection. And I think the closest that the Bible comes to it is this word Philadelphia. It's the love between siblings. Traditionally rendered as brotherly love, it's the bond of affection that you have as a product of growing up together, of belonging to the same family, of being blood relatives. There's just a special bond that generates in a healthy family. And then finally, the fourth type of love is agape love. You might have heard of that. It's an expression of a kind of altruism. It's where you give for the good of another, not particularly expecting anything in return. It's not because the recipient's attractive and you're seeking some kind of intimacy or union with them. It's done out of a decision to do good to people. And this word, if you're reading the King James Version, you know the famous wedding passage, 1 Corinthians 13. The word there in the King James Version, agape, is translated as charity, to kind of try to capture that altruistic dimension to it. Now, throughout Christian history, Christians have tended to favour that last one as the real definition of Christian love, the one that captured the essence of how God's loved us and how we're to love one another. Agape has been the privileged definition of what love looks like. The way Jesus loved his disciples, the way God loves us in covenant, our love for each other as believers, and even our love for our enemies. Obviously, it's about the only love you can imagine having for enemies. As long as we don't have to like them, we can love them. Now, it's that privileging of that particular kind of love, defined in those very kind of limited terms, that I want to put to the test from a couple of passages in the New Testament. And the first one's Romans 12, 9 to 21. So if you turn to Romans 12, it's the passage that Mitch read out to us. And I'll explain what I'm hoping to illustrate as we go along. But Romans 12, and look back to begin with at verses 1 and 2. Because what Paul's spelling out in this chapter is the wholehearted commitment that he expects us to have to a God who is jealous, a God who has loved us with a compassionate love. Paul begins there in Romans 12, "Therefore, brothers and sisters, in view of the mercies of God." All right, just stop a moment. Take account of the way God has loved you so compassionately and kindly. Think of the first 11 chapters of Romans and the way Paul spelt that out. Now keep that in your mind. And now we're going to work out what's the appropriate response to a God who's loved you like that. And he goes on to say, I urge you to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true worship. Do not be conformed to this age, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may discern what is good, pleasing, and the perfect will of God. So what we're looking at is the wholehearted, whole of life, lock, stock, and barrel response to the God who's loved us with that love that we've been talking about yesterday. Now, that passionate, jealous, tender-hearted, forgiving love that we've experienced, this is the response that God expects from us. And he expects all of us. This is in line with what we said yesterday about jealousy. God wants us lock, stock, and barrel. He wants a whole body sacrifice. This is what worship is in the Bible. One of the unfortunate things that's happened in our language is we tend to associate worship with what we do at church and particularly what musicians do. And that sometimes is just a bit of kind of verbal slippage, a bit of semantic kind of messiness. But here Paul's explaining what worship truly is. And you can see the poverty of referring to church or music as our worship. It's in danger of the age-old trick of going, look, how about we give you 20 cents in the dollar or even less? You want the whole of us in response to you. You want a wholehearted obedience. How about we settle for 2 hours on church and we'll really throw ourselves into the singing? One of the worst blasphemies, I think, that's associated with that whole thing is I've heard people say that the musicians at church lead us into the presence of God. I always thought Jesus did that. Anyway, that's enough of my rant against the way we talk about worship sometimes. What Paul's envisaging is a whole of life, whole of self commitment to the God who has loved us with the love that we talked about yesterday. Now, what we get then from verse 9 onwards in this passage, as part of that whole of life commitment, is the call to love. In verse 9, the version that we read said, let love be without hypocrisy. Let love be without hypocrisy. Now, in the original, there's not actually a verb there. And this will be important. I'll try to explain the importance of that. But in the original Greek, it simply says, love without hypocrisy. And it's not the verb love, it's the noun love. And what that means, not having a verb in there, in the Greek, means that it really functions like a heading. Right? Paul's introducing a topic in speaking like that. So what you could think as you read through this passage is that he deals with the topic of love in the first bit of verse 9, and then he moves on to a series of other topics. Whereas the way that it's communicated in the Greek, it's much more likely that verse 9 is a heading over the next 12 or 13 verses. And so this is what unhypocritical love looks like. This is what sincere love looks like. This is what genuine love looks like. And that's what, you know, from our introduction to today, that's what we crave more than anything. We need guidance. We need clarity. We need love to be defined for us. And really, that's what Paul is doing here in Romans 12 verses 9 and following. And what I want to draw your attention to, well, the important thing is that the word love is that word agape. So we're about to see how the Bible defines agape and whether it defines it in that kind of strictly altruistic charity kind of way. And as soon as we read on, we find that there is this irreducible emotional dimension to the biblical vision of what love is. The biblical vision of what agape love is. And immediately he says, detest evil. Cling to what is good. If you're going to practice genuine love, there are a whole range of things in your life that you will have to resist. There are a whole range of evil things that are love killers, that are destructive for relationships of love. It may be envy of the achievements of others. It might be a love of gossip, that kind of phony intimacy that's created by sharing secrets behind people's back. It might be pornography, That's the evil that's preventing you from loving as you ought. It could be an arrogance about your own achievement, where you set yourself up as superior to other people in some way. It might be your need for people's praise. Now, I could list a whole range of others, but all of these things and many more are love killers. They harm the kinds of relationships that God wants us to have. So the first thing we need to do, if we're going to practice the kind of love that Paul, that God ultimately is talking about, is we're going to have to learn to hate those things, detest those things, because we recognise they're so contrary to the will of God, so contrary to his purposes, but they stunt and deform our expressions of love towards other people. It's just inevitable. If we cling to evil, we really lack the capacity to love as we ought. Now, as you move on, very soon, verse 10, we get some more irreducibly emotional stuff. And we're told to practice, well, we're told to love one another deeply as brothers and sisters. Love one another deeply as brothers and sisters. There's kind of two components to this, two words that Paul makes use of to kind of draw this out. And again, remember, this is all nesting within the word agape. But he goes on and he uses the word Philadelphia. So we're to think of each other as brothers and sisters. We are family. God has adopted us into his family. And so there's a quality of affection that we ought to have that's consistent with the kind of love that a healthy family has for the members of that family, for other brothers and sisters. It's that kind of warm affection. It's that kind of desire to be with each other and have fun with each other, share with each other, do life together, that kind of thing. And in fact, we are blood relatives with each other. As you look around this room, each person here who belongs to Christ was purchased with the price of his shed blood. We are blood relations because of that, and that ought to issue in genuinely affectionate, warm relationships where we love being in each other's company, where we're inclined to hug each other and greet each other with a holy kiss, that kind of expression. And I know that's all been limited and restricted by masks and by COVID. But now is the time we can start breaking out of that and returning to the kind of affection that people show to each other when they love each other like brothers and sisters. The second component is a kind of a compound of the word that C.S. Lewis uses in his book. It's philostorgos, and this is a really powerful word, a very strong word that's really about the kind of intensity of love that a parent has for a child. Or a grandfather has for his nomies. It's not used in elsewhere in the New Testament, this particular word, but it is used a few times in a book called Four Maccabees. And here's one little extract from it to give you a bit of an idea of what we're talking about, what Paul conveys with this word. O sacred nature and affection of parental love, yearning of parents towards offspring, nurture an indomitable suffering by mothers. You know, this is the kind of love you have for another human being that you bore in your womb, that you carried for 9 months, that, you know, came out of your body and that woke you up, you know, in the middle of the night for months. It's that kind of intense love that a parent will identify with most quickly. And certainly I identify with my own children. You know, I could find myself walking along a street and just imagine one of my children being hurt, and it'd be like a shard of glass going through me. That's the kind of attachment that you have to your own children. And Paul, you know, kind of drags like a doona at night, kind of drags that over from the world of parental love into our congregational relationships and our love for each other. This intense, you know, we hurt when other people are hurt. Or just the thought of people being hurt, we kind of hurt with that. But it's that yearning and affection that characterises parental love. He'll go on in verse 11 to talk about being diligent in zeal. It's actually the same word as the word for jealousy So there's a sense in which you could translate it as, do not lack diligence in jealousy. And hopefully yesterday gave you a bit of a framework where you might imagine that translation and how it might play out. But we'll stick with the word zeal. The English versions tend to prefer that in this context, and others like it. He says, be diligent in zeal, be fervent in spirit. And often our unwillingness to love the way that we're meant to is a symptom of a lack of spiritual vitality. And often the two go hand in hand. And the fact, you know, it's a diagnostic kind of tool. You're stepping up and loving people as you ought. Well, then, how are you going in your relationship with God? Are you maintaining your relationship with God? Are you aware of how loved you are? Do you walk around conscious that you're a child of God and you've been adopted into his family? Are you often moved by the compassion that he's shown you? Do you know just how beloved you are to God? Because that'll often be a real measure of just how you're maintaining your zeal and how fervent you are in the Spirit. Now, the love that Paul's describing in these verses is a costly love that'll take you on kind of roller coaster rides with distinct highs and lows, engaging in relationships marked by this kind of affection and parental angst. Look at verse 15. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. Back in verse 12, he said, rejoice in hope. So that's the source of our joy there is in the prospect of our resurrection bodies and the thought that Jesus will return one day and take us to be with God. Uninterrupted joy in his presence. So that's a distinct source of joy in our lives and characteristic of this love that we have for each other. But then verse 15, it's a different source. The source is human relationships, our relationships with each other. They will very often be a source of joy. You will be drawn in as you love the way that you ought, as you love your brothers and sisters around you. You'll be drawn into extraordinary joy when someone finds a job after months of unemployment, when someone receives news that the insurance will cover the damage, or that the growth is benign after all, or the friend at work they've been praying for became a Christian, or a young couple at church announced their engagement, or another couple announces that they're pregnant after years of trying. There will be so much scope for you to enter into the joy of other people around you. Church will draw you into those kinds of experiences where something that doesn't touch your life directly is a source of joy, genuine elation, exhilaration because of the nature of the attachment that you formed to a variety of people at church. Conversely, those same entanglements will bring you low with sympathy pains, tragedies and disappointments that aren't yours exactly, but become yours because you have loved another person. And so we're called to weep with those who weep, to enter into their pain, share in it, and shed tears with them. I remember a night an unbeliever joined our Bible study group. He was the nephew of a woman on staff at church. She hoped that we might get on with each other. It was a pretty standard night of Bible study. We read through a portion of Jeremiah together. We answered some questions fairly lamely and then shared prayer points. Rachel had been out of work for 6 months. Sharon was going through a very painful divorce after an abusive relationship with her husband, and she talked about that. Gina's legs were playing up and she couldn't get around easily. Gary's car was broken down again and he couldn't afford to fix it. And as this fella left my house, I caught up with him at the door and I asked him how it went. And with great candour and honesty, he said to me, "Mate, I'm not hanging around here. You're just a pack of losers." And for some reason, he came back. And he kept coming back. And then more than a year later, after sitting in Bible study patiently across that year, taking in what he could. I remember Lottie was 92 and a daughter used to bring her along and she'd regularly turn to him and go, Steve, God's coming to get you. You're a goner. And Steve would say, oh. Steve became a Christian and for the last 20 years or so has worked as a prison chaplain in a maximum security prison. And he couldn't hang around with a bigger backpack of losers to weep with and rejoice with. But the gospel gripped him. And the gospel changed him. And he loves those people deeply from the heart. And I'm delighted to say his son's in the audience. Anyway, that's a story that's very precious to me. As I reflect on more than 50 years as a conscious Christian, it's easy to calculate the fact that I could have been spared the bulk of pain that I've experienced in my life if I'd simply not bothered going to church. If I hadn't belonged to Christ, if I hadn't belonged to his people, if I hadn't been bound together with those people by this bond of love that we're talking about, I could have spared myself so much pain. Not being dragged through other people's crap. Not swimming neck deep in other people's sewage. I could have spared myself of all of that if I just hadn't been a Christian. But then I have to face the fact that I would have lost 90% of the joy in my life that comes from being connected to other people in that way. I would have lost all those opportunities to share in their delight at things that happened to them that worked so well, that went so well. And I have to face the fact of, well, who would have been there to weep with me? Who would have been there to weep with me when Kim was diagnosed with incurable cancer? Who would have been there to weep with me when my mother died or my brother died? Who would have been there to weep with me when my marriage broke down? Where would I have been without my Christian brothers and sisters rallying around? I'm not saying it was only Christians, but it's the Christians who kind of conscientiously stepped up to love me and weep with me through the darkest and most difficult times in my life. And that comes because of God's extraordinarily wonderful plan to bring a bunch of people like us together and bind us together with these silly ties of affection and love that then enable us to get through life together and to love each other through life, to be praying for each other, looking out for each other, catching up with each other when we have opportunity, showing hospitality to each other. Can I just say, you know, hospitality came up in Romans 12 and it's absolutely integral to the kind of love that we're talking about. It's not particularly an emotion term, so I haven't kind of zeroed in on it. But really, the beginning of the revolution that we need in how we love each other is really hospitality. It's having people, you know, not even necessarily having people in your house if you're ashamed of your house or you can't get it tidy or whatever. You don't need dinner parties. You don't need to turn stuff on. You know, just take someone for a cream bun or something, you know. Shout them a pineapple donut. I'd love that. But, you know, just signal to people gratuitously, I'd like to spend time with you. What, to go through the rosters? No. What, to plan youth group? No. Well, why? Just thought it'd be good to spend time together, just to chill, just to chew the fat. You up for it? And that's really the time that gives you the opportunity to listen, the extended listening that allows you to tune into what's going on for people, that allows you to strengthen these ties and bonds that are there objectively in the gospel. You can't get away from these bonds. They're yours in the gospel, the fact that you're bound together by this. It's just what Paul is calling you to do is step up, roll your sleeves up and love like this. Let's look at now at Ephesians 4. Need to move on. Like the other two talks, I want to take you to another passage that could easily have been the central focus of this talk, but that reinforces the sorts of things we're talking about. Ephesians 4, 25-5:2. And we'll work through this relatively quickly because there's a bit of overlap and I don't want to labour things too much and I don't want to take up too much time. But the thing that fascinates me with Ephesians 4 and why I do want to take you there, even though we've looked at Romans 12, which I think is, you know, the classic passage in the New Testament to define love, to define agape love. And again, agape love has irreducible emotional content when you look through that definition. Okay? But when we go to Ephesians 4, 25-52, there's a different kind of twist. These verses are suspended between two really, really interesting verses. Have a look at Ephesians 4, verse 24, where Paul talks to us about putting on the new self, the one created according to God's likeness, in righteousness and purity of truth. So what we've got in this passage is Paul's outlining the process by which we become the new person that God has recreated us to be. And we're being refashioned into God's likeness. Now that's God's project in you and in us as a congregation. That's what God's now working on in you, to reshape you, refashion you according to his likeness. Now go on down to chapter 5 verse 1. Because to me this is just such an intriguing bookend to the section that we're looking at. There he says, therefore, be imitators of God as dearly loved children and walk in love as Christ also loved us and gave himself for us, a sacrificial and fragrant offering to God. So now in this bit, this is how we cooperate in God's project. This is where we exercise our agency. We understand that God is at work in us, but then we actively participate by choosing to imitate God, wanting to be like him, cultivate his character. And in the verses in between, Paul will nominate some crucial areas in which we need to work that out. And again, surprise, surprise, we're going to find that it involves a whole range of emotional issues and how we handle them. What he wants us to do, though, is remember that we are beloved children. That's what he says in chapter 5, verse 1. As dearly loved children, that was the title of my PhD. The starting point for all of this is for us to reflect on the way that we have been loved, the abundance of God's faithful love towards us, the tender-hearted compassion, the jealous urgency, and now we must live as children who've been on the receiving end of that kind of love. And as you go through in Ephesians 4, 25 to the end of the chapter, that will have implications for your anger. Be angry and do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. It's a crucial aspect of your holiness and righteousness, being conformed to the image of God, how you handle your anger. It's a very important verse because there's a number of verses in the New Testament that arrive at a very negative assessment of human anger. Very rare that human anger aligns with the righteous purposes of God. James' letter will tell you that, and a number of other places as well. Jesus will suggest that in Matthew 5. But this verse makes it clear that it is possible for us to be angry but not sin, to echo the righteous anger of God. Now, moments like this are rare in my life, but I remember one vividly when a young girl came to me and told me that she'd been sexually abused by the youth leader at church. In the days that followed, I took action that I look back on now and think, wow, how did I do that? Like, you know, I got in contact with the Department of Community Services and spoke to someone there. I lined up counselling for the girl. I took a whole range of steps that I look back now on and go, how did I manage that in a day? And as I look back, it was really anger that motivated me. It was anger working like anger's meant to work. You know, you look at a situation, you perceive a terrible injustice that's been done to someone, a terrible abuse that's been committed. You're gripped by anger, righteous anger at what's happened, and it impels you to take action. It gives you a courage you didn't have before. And you see how anger is meant to work. You see how the divine anger works. You see how Jesus' anger works in the Gospels, when you kind of have those very, very rare experiences of being able to say that that was a righteous anger. I was amazed at how galvanized I was. Now, at the same time, that needs to be held in tension with verse 31. Verse 31 says, let all bitterness, anger, and wrath, shouting, and slander be removed from you. Now, that's much more in keeping with the kind of negative assessments that I talked about before. And some of you will be all too aware of how that spectrum of angry feeling and angry speaking has impacted you. As you sit here over this weekend, you might have had a number of occasions to reflect on how you have been on the receiving end of rage and anger that was anything but righteous. Might have been your experience as a small child, or as you grew up. You might have experienced it in a marriage. Most of us know the shame of road rage, the disproportionate reactions to minor inconveniences. But an even bigger challenge for us is our righteous anger. It's much more tempting for us to cling to anger when we feel, even know, that we're entitled to it, when we know that a great injustice has been done to us. And what Paul calls us to do is to stop and think about, what did God do with his anger towards you? Was he entitled to it? Was he justified? Did you deserve it? Well, what did he do? How did he deal with his anger? He found a way to spare you his anger and be able to forgive you at the cross. And now that same cross is the model and the means by which we deal with our anger, and gives us the ability to seek reconciliation and ask forgiveness even when people have been angry towards us in unacceptable ways. Now, that needs to be qualified in a range of situations where people have been in abusive relationships. You'd give a different kind of advice and you'd work it through a little bit differently. So please don't hear me saying you've got to be able to deal with what you've been through this simple mechanism. But for most of us, with our regular experiences of anger, we need to take it to the cross. To that taxonomy of fury, Paul adds malice. He says, along with malice, malice is kind of fermented anger that you've clung on to so far, so long, that you've got a sort of settled hatred and contempt for another person. And Paul says, you're going to have to get rid of it. And again, he will take us to the cross down in verse 32. He says, be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving one another, just as God also forgave you in Christ. Nowhere is that compassion displayed as clearly as the cross. And the cross was not just the means by which our sin was crucified, so that it could no longer hold us captive to death and to judgment. The cross is now the means by which we navigate our way through the emotional responses that are unworthy of a beloved child of God. The cross enables us to put away anger and malice even when we are convinced it is justified, because that's exactly what God did for us in his tender-hearted compassion towards us. And that's how we're renewed in his likeness, as we live a life of love just as he loved us. Okay then, how then shall we love? Let's wrap up. After that excursion through some New Testament notions of love and what we learn about love, how should God's word shape us as we try to love one another in a whole range of contexts, at church, in our family, at work? Well, one of the most surprising things about the New Testament is that it commands emotions. And for some people, that's really confronting, even scandalous. It's one of the features that we've explored, that the Bible will tell us that there are emotions that we ought to experience, that we ought to cultivate. As I mentioned yesterday, the Bible doesn't distinguish good and bad emotions, but there are situations where we ought to feel grief over our sin and we ought to weep over our sin. There are situations where we ought to grieve over the hard-heartedness and rebelliousness of people that we know, people that we love. There are situations where we ought to be anxious for our brothers and sisters and for people at church. There are other situations where we ought to remind ourselves that God provides for us and put away our anxiety. Times when it's right to feel jealous, times when it's not. But the Bible will regularly say to us, you ought to love like this, and will command certain emotional responses. And I think that's because the Bible authors are convinced that in the gospel, we have the resources to enable those emotions, even reactivate those emotions, if we've learnt not to experience and express them. That's part of God's renewal of you in his image, is that he's prepared by his Spirit to work on your internal world and your emotional world. So if this weekend leaves you feeling like, oh, I'm a bit stunted, oh, I'm a bit, oh, I'm, you know, it's not, I don't really know what to do with emotions, there is hope. This is part of God's project in making you more like Jesus. The other thing is that we've got to move beyond that traditional definition of agape. It's what I call, what I refer to as an agape reductionism, where we try to restrict love to that altruistic, disinterested product of the will that's just a decision that we make. This is what I heard the preacher say at a wedding not that long ago to a Christian couple. He said, love is not a feeling, it's a decision. All right? Now, if he just said, love is not only a feeling, it's a decision, I might have let him get away with it. But, you know, that feeds our naivety and ignorance of emotions when preachers stand up, and I hear them do it regularly, stand up and say, love is not a feeling, it's a decision of the will. Now, we've seen that that just doesn't do justice to agape. It doesn't do justice to God's love, and it doesn't do justice to the love that we're called to. Thankfully, love isn't a two-dimensional decision of the will. The life of love that we're called to is ridiculously rich and rich in emotional experience. Weeping with those who weep, rejoicing with those who rejoice, showing brotherly affection, being gripped by that parental kind of ache. You know, it's a very rich thing, and we need to understand and explore the richness of this. Now, in fact, I can find all of the different types of love, some of the loves that we're inclined to dismiss. The Bible kind of walks this line where it describes God's love for us in erotic terms, of God, you know, longing and panting after us like a wife, and he'll, like his wife, and he'll depict his people as kind of whores who've run after other gods and had it off with them under every green tree. And you're kind of going, man, this Bible ought to be X-rated. You can only read this after 9:30 at night. You know, this is unbelievable. You know, but it'll be that kind of in your face. And I think what we've traditionally tried to do is, well, wait on, you know, God elects people, and we know that he doesn't elect people because there's something attractive in them, something that he wants in them. You know, why he elects Israel has got nothing to do with Israel. It's got to do with him setting his love on people. But then when we stop reading the Bible at that point, and we don't realise that once God sets his love on people, he sets his love with a passionate, jealous, urgent, compassionate love. That's the way God attaches himself to his chosen people, and we saw that being played out. But we need to restore these rich elements so that we really understand what love is. I think what's happened, and I see the mechanics of this quite a bit, is, you know, we've often defined love from dysfunctional situations. If you're talking to a Christian brother or sister in a deeply depressed state, it's just kind of cruel to say to them, oh, you really need to step up and love people like this. Right? We need to recognise that there are situations where people get disabled by what other circumstances they're in. Maybe they're overwhelmed with grief, and you just can't expect them to practice this kind of love. But the problem is, we then lower the bar so they can still get over it, and that becomes left as our definition of what love is. And that actually leaves them in a terrible position, because where are the people who are stepping up and loving the depressed brother or sister with an affectionate, passionate love, if you've set the bar down here at this kind of empty altruism? I think that's what we've tended to do. It's like that advice I got at youth group. It was designed pragmatically to help us cope and accept awkward, difficult people. But then that became the definition of love. You don't have to like someone, you just have to love them. Now, after all that I've said about emotion, and I've given a really, you know, given a pretty positive pitch for emotion, there are some pitfalls and dangers in our fallen world and our fallen natures. Our emotions are often distorted and misleading. While we need to grapple with our emotional world, there are times when that's best done with professional help. to help us learn to distinguish and discern the intelligence that emotions carry about our lives. There will be people who practice a kind of emotional exhibitionism or indulgent self-expression, who learn that emotional expression is a way to get attention, and that's always a bit of a danger after someone's talked the way that I've talked. Or it can foster an unhealthy introspection with what's going on in my heart and my kidneys and my bowels. But if we're going to love the way Christ loved us, we do have to grapple with this world of feeling and emotion. The real danger, the real risk, is if we really love, if we engage with one another as family, if we have the affection for one another that weeps with those who weep, if we burn with indignation when people are mistreated, if we love with a love that enters into the pain of loss of others with genuine love, that may end up being the biggest regret from having been at a weekend like this. But that is love. And that's what Jesus teaches us unmistakably. Look where love brought Jesus. Look where love took Jesus. Look what love cost Jesus. Look where his love for you brought him. Look where his love for you took him. Look what his love for you cost him. No one defines love more clearly and fully and more richly than Jesus. So therefore, be imitators of God as dearly loved children, and walk in love as Christ also loved us and gave himself up for us, a sacrificial and fragrant offering to God. Amen.